So, fresh out of business school, this young man answered a want ad for an accountant. He had just gotten a CPA degree. And he goes in for his interview with this very nervous man running a small business. And that he had started up by himself. And he is told by this owner, I need someone with an accounting degree. But mainly, I'm looking for someone to do the worrying for me here. Excuse me, the accountant said. Well, you know, I worry about a lot of things. I don't want to have to worry about money. Your job will be to take all the money worries off my back. I see, the accountant said. Well, how much does this job pay? I'll start you at $80,000. $80,000, the accountant exclaimed. How can such a small business afford a sum like that? The owner said, that is your first worry. So, our livelihood can be very complicated. And I think, you know, the two aspects of life where we probably spend the most time to become the most complicated, perhaps the most difficult, are personal relationships, especially intimate romantic relationships, and our careers. So tonight I thought we'd explore finding joy and purpose in right livelihood. And so first I'll talk about right livelihood and wrong livelihood as explained by the Buddha. I like to start right out with some quotes by the Buddha because I want to have my back, you know. And we'll sort of explore some nuances and complications about that because it's not a black and white issue, as you may have noticed. And then let's address how we use our practice in the context of right livelihood. So let's start with what the Buddha had to say about it. Of course, in his time, it was very different, and he encouraged his disciples to make their living in a way that did not cause harm and ideally was ethically positive. He said, quote, these five trades should not be taken up: trading in weapons, living beings, meat, intoxicants, and poisons. So everybody's going, let's see, check, 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 check. I'm good. Hopefully. So right livelihood as an expression is one of the Eightfold Path. So let's just back up a little bit and talk about where the Eightfold Path came from. It comes out of the Four Noble Truths, which was the first teaching of the Buddha. It's the core of the Buddhist teaching. And if you go deep into the teachings of the Buddha, you keep bumping up against it because that is the foundation. Just reviewing quickly the Four Noble Truths. The first one is basically the truth of suffering, the fact that suffering, dukkha, and satisfactoriness, however we translate it, is pervasive in our lives. And the second noble truth is he talked about the cause of suffering. And basically the cause of suffering is clinging, craving, wanting things to be different. So it's craving and aversion, pulling, pushing. The third noble truth is that there is a way out of this, the good news. And the fourth noble truth is he laid out the path. And as complicated as Buddhism might seem, and all you got to do is go to Barnes & Noble, go to a bookstore, go out there and look at our bookshelf. There's all these books. Seems like it could get really complicated. But he really helped us out by laying out a path. He said, here's the Eightfold Path. You do this, and you'll find freedom from suffering. So the Four Noble Truths really express the basic orientation of Buddhism and how to get out of it. It's the heart of the path. The Eightfold Path can be summarized, it's really in three different categories. One of them has to do with virtue or ethics, and in Pali that's referred to as sila, S-I-L-A. The second aspect of it is concentration or samadhi, and the third is wisdom or panya. So if you look at them, there's two of them are in the wisdom category, three of them are in the ethics category, and three of them are in the concentration category. So livelihood is obviously in the ethics category. Virtue, morality, which, by the way, is also addressed in the five precepts. So a large part of our waking life is spent earning a living. So it's easy to appreciate why we should try to be moderately happy in our job. But choosing a suitable career, like choosing a marriage partner, is one of the most difficult tasks in life in many cases. And our work is such a part of our life that if we're unhappy there, it's really difficult to be happy in our life. I know that one. I've seen it really impact my life when I was miserable in the manner in which I was trying to earn a living. So let's go and talk about what the Buddha said about right livelihood and wrong livelihood. And for that, I'm going to quote Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a monk who is a translator and just a brilliant, he brilliantly explains what the Buddha had to say. So what he said was, right livelihood is concerned with ensuring that one earns one's living in a righteous way. For a lay disciple, as opposed to a monastic, the Buddha teaches that wealth should be gained in accordance with certain standards. One should acquire it only by legal means, not illegally. Acquire it peacefully, without coercion or violence. One should acquire it honestly, not by trickery or deceit. And one should acquire it in ways that do not entail harm and suffering for others. The Buddha mentions five specific kinds of livelihood which bring harm to others and therefore are to be avoided. So, again, dealing with weapons in living beings, which also includes raising animals for slaughter, as well as slave trade and prostitution, in meat production and butchery, in poisons and in intoxicants. He further names several dishonest means of gaining wealth which fall under wrong livelihood: practicing deceit, treachery, soothsaying, trickery, and usury. Obviously, any occupation that requires violation of free speech and right action is a wrong form of livelihood. But other occupations, such as selling weapons or intoxicants, may not violate these factors, and yet be wrong because of the consequences for others. So in the context of the Buddhist teachings, a fine line may very well separate right livelihood from wrong livelihood. Right livelihood generally is respectable, honorable, and most of all harmless. But you know, two people could be doing it, could be in the same work position, and one performs the job honestly and in good faith, and the other dishonestly. They could be working side by side. And the question of whether work is wholesome or unwholesome, it's not intrinsic to the job itself. So here's an example. I was living in Phoenix in the 90s, and I decided to get a real estate license. And the reason I did this was because my girlfriend at the time had a friend who was making an obscene amount of money in real estate. And I looked at this person and I thought, I'm a better salesperson than she is. I'd been in sales for about 20 years, been pretty successful. I thought, I can do this. Well, she was selling timeshare Anybody know anything about timeshare? Well, I will say that I think, in theory, it's a good concept. But unfortunately, it's riddled with deception in many cases, not all. And if anybody in here has sold timeshare, you understand this. So I go and get my license, and I'm immediately hired by this company. It was actually the Embassy Suites, had a timeshare in Phoenix. And I'm having a lot of problems, and I'm just not getting sales, and I'm getting really frustrated. And after a while, I figured out why this friend was making all this money and I wasn't. She was lying her ass off. In fact, most of the people there were lying their ass off, up and down. In fact, I might have been the only person there that was telling the truth all the time. And I was starving. And so here's an example of, you know, how, an intrinsically honest position can really be problematic. How about being a bartender? Now, he's got it right here in black and white, selling intoxicants. I happen to know a bartender who happens to be in recovery, by the way, which that would seem to be tricky, but it's not for him. And he says that in his position as a bartender, he firmly believes he has saved people's lives. He has had people in front of him who wanted to go home and kill themselves, and he's talked them out of it, talked them into going for help. He has had people who were going to go out and get behind the wheel of their car. He talked them into taking a cab ride home. So it's not black and white, is it? I had a friend who, when I lived in Phoenix, I met him in the 80s, who was an engineer. His name is Ray, and he was single father of two children. The mother was out of the picture. He worked for Motorola, designing missile guidance systems. And one day he sat down with me and he said, "Eddie, I know that some of these missiles are being used to deploy weapons, and I may be designing something that could end up killing innocent people." And he really struggled with that. What do I do? And changing jobs can get really tricky. For example, there was a high school teacher who was very unsatisfied with his job, so she quit it and decided to go looking for work. And she was so confident she wouldn't have trouble finding a new position, because there was a nationwide shortage of teachers, right? So she starts emailing cover letters to all these potential employers, and she attached the same resume to each cover letter. 6 months later, she was astonished and disappointed that she hadn't received any interview requests. Then she finally got an email response from a school, from an employer, that explained why perhaps she hadn't heard from anyone. And the email message said, "Your resume was not attached as you indicated, but I want to thank you so much for the roast lamb recipe you attached." So, you know, when you go to quit jobs, it can get a little tricky sometimes. Ray ended up staying on at Motorola, you know? So, given that almost everyone's life includes an economic dimension, work and career need to be integrated to life as a Buddhist. Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh wrote, "To practice right livelihood, you have to find a way to earn your living without transgressing your ideals of love and compassion. The way you support yourself can be an expression of your deepest self, or it can be a source of suffering for you and others. Our vocation can nourish our understanding and compassion, or it can erode them. We should be awake to the consequences, far and near, of the way we earn our living. That's from his book, The Heart of the Buddhist Teachings. So these are some questions we might ask ourselves. Is the end product wholesome? In our work, what's the product or service being delivered? Regardless in our role in producing it, you're probably contributing some effect in the world. Is it a beneficial service? Is the end product supported by your effort and on balance wholesome? So I lived for 6 months in a Zen center in California. Some of you might have heard of called Green Gulch. It's part of the San Francisco Zen Center. And I wasn't actually paid. It was my work practice. I got a stipend while I was there. But I worked in the kitchen. And it was so gratifying to me because I was preparing food for people who were doing practice. And as I was chopping vegetables and making soups and salads and preparing foods and serving them, I was aware that everything I was doing was being used by people who were practicing the Dharma in one way or the other, whether it was a formal practice or going out and tending the gardens or taking care of guests. So I felt that my end product was very, very wholesome, not just in terms of the ingredients of the food, but in terms of the effort that was being put into it. Another question to ask is your work environment wholesome? Is the place where you perform your work safe? Are you surrounded by people who are mostly trying to do the right thing? There may be a mix of positive and negative personalities around you, but what's the ratio in your workplace? Is it so negative that a positive conversation is not really possible? Or is it generally uplifting? Is there a sense that everyone is constantly overworked? Is this going to impact what kind of awareness, what kind of effort you put into your work? Is it going to impact the effect of what you're putting out? I worked in food service at a couple of grocery stores here when I first moved to Asheville, Green Life and Whole Foods. I'm making sandwiches. I'm making pizza. If I'm pissed off, do you think that shows up in the food? I think so. And the interesting thing was, it was never the customers. The customers were easy. Even the difficult ones, it was my coworkers. They're the ones I had the challenge with. I could say a lot about that, but I won't. Skillful speech. But you know, what's it like to go to work? Do you say to yourself things like, you know, I don't mind coming to work, but that 8-hour wait to go home is really a bitch. Or do you say to yourself, I work solely so I can afford the amount of alcohol it takes to go to work? You know, if you're saying those kind of things to yourself, another question about, basic question to ask yourself, does your work include aspects that seem unethical to you? In the course of your work, are you sometimes asked to do things that you consider unethical? Remember, unethical is not the same as unpleasant. Firing someone is really unpleasant. Anybody ever fire anyone? It's not fun. But you know, I have fired people, and I knew it was not only in the company's best interest and mine as a manager, but it was in theirs. They really needed to make a career change. They just weren't very good at what they were doing. They weren't a good fit. And I could do it in good conscience, but it was really unpleasant. And getting fired, and I've been fired a few times, is not unpleasant. And a couple of the times I was fired, it was for good reason. I didn't belong there. I wasn't doing the job. And there's stories about that. Are you sometimes expected to break one of the five precepts? Don't kill, don't lie, don't engage in sexual misconduct, don't steal, and don't take intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. Are you breaking them on your own when no one asks you to do those things? Do you find that you're spending a lot of your work doing something other than the work you're being paid for? I'm on this bulletin board. I'm a Yankee fan, okay? So if there are any Red Sox fans in here, don't hate me. But I'm a Yankee fan, so I'm on this bulletin board, and it's kind of fun. I don't have any friends who are Yankee fans, so I got to find them online. And so I go on there, and I know there's people in there posting constantly through the day who are at work. Somebody's paying them to be on the inline, on the internet to talk about spring training right now. Is that stealing? The precept that's often commonly abused in the workplace is truthfulness. I know a secretary who quit her job because her boss kept expecting her to lie. And it went beyond just, no, he's not in right now when he's standing there. It went way beyond that. How does your current work affect you? When I lived in Phoenix in the 80s, I had one customer that I was calling on who worked for a company called American Continental Corporation. Well, American Continental Corporation was directed by a man by the name of Charles Keating. Anybody ever hear of Charles Keating? Well, Charles Keating was at the center of a savings and loan scandal that ended up a lot of people lost a lot of money, and he actually went to jail. Well, this woman was an executive secretary for him. And her instructions were, he told her, basically that he wanted her to be able to get on a plane and go anywhere he wanted her to within, I think it was like 2 hours' notice. At any given day, 24/7, she was expected that she would be at the airport on a 2-hour notice to fly out. And she told me, she goes, Eddie, I don't have a life. Oh, and the other part was, he was paying her about 3 times the normal salary. He was paying her an incredible amount of money. So she was trying to balance this. And she finally quit her job before they put Chuck in jail. So, you know, all this stuff, it really requires that we pay attention to what's happening around us and notice what's going on in our surroundings and what's happening inside us. So, let's talk about right view. Well, right view is another one of the Eightfold Path. It's actually the first one in the wisdom section, and it's the very first one that the Buddha laid out. And it basically talks about understanding the nature of reality. That's the point of right view. Understanding suffering, the origin of suffering, the sensation of suffering, understanding things like impermanence and no self and so on. It's a deep understanding of the nature of reality. And we can look at it like, if we're going to follow the path and we don't have right view, how are we going to get there? It's kind of like, if I want to go to Charleston and I get out on the highway and I follow the sign that's taking me to Knoxville, we've got a problem here. I'm not going to get to Charleston. So it's the same kind of thing. It kind of points us in the direction of having clear view. And if I'm really going to have, if I'm really going to take a look at my surroundings, my work environment, look at the gray areas, and look at how I'm responding to these situations, it's really important to have clear view, right view. Otherwise, I'm going to be headed in the wrong direction and confused. So, that's all I'm going to say about that. I could really spend some time on right view, but I want to talk about how to cultivate right livelihood. There's some things that we can do. One is mindfulness of body. By remaining aware of our body, we can really check in and see what's happening. How do we know when we're behaving unethically? Does our body sometimes give us a message? When we're feeling stressed and we know that something's wrong, does our body give us a message? Can we, if we learn to check in with our body, we can really get signals and indicators. The body is our messenger. That's why when we do the meditation, when we do mindfulness practice, we check into our body first. And the breath is one of the ways of doing that. Just noticing breath coming in, breath going out. And we can notice the subtleties of the breath. Is it jagged? Is it smooth? Is it bumpy? Is the in-breath longer than the out-breath? And so on. Just tuning into the body really helps us become aware of what's going on. It's like the story of my friend who was a rageaholic, and he started practicing mindfulness practices. He was afraid that he was going to lose his job because he kept blowing up at work. But he was practicing mindfulness. And one day, a woman at work said something that upset him, and he shared with those of us that he could feel the sensation in his body. And because he had been doing his practice, he recognized that it was anger, and he knew what was going to come next. So what did he do? He took a breath. He dropped into his body. He softened, created some space, and looked at the woman and said, "I need a couple of minutes," and he stepped away. Mindfulness of body. Another way to cultivate right livelihood is by non-attachment to our thoughts. Recognizing that we're not our thoughts. We don't have to cling to this notion that we have to believe all our thoughts. Not getting identified with our views about things, getting attached. If we can notice that our thoughts are just thoughts and let them go, we're less likely to get caught in some kind of habitual pattern of believing in non-reality and acting out in a way that's not constructive, in a way that's harmful. So going back to that situation where I was working at a company which will remain unnamed, making sandwiches, when people would do things that would upset me, like, for example, I would check the sandwiches and my coworker had gotten the brilliant idea that even though the sandwich said sun-dried tomatoes, that he wanted to be creative and put in roasted red peppers. But the label says sun-dried tomatoes. And when I saw that and I approached him and he said, "Ah, they'll never notice the difference." I'm thinking, wait till somebody goes into anaphylactic shock in front of his workstation. But anyway, I'm noticing the sensations in the body, the anger coming up. I'm noticing how I'm getting really attached to being right. I'm noticing what I'm about to say. And I don't say that. And I breathe, and I can handle it skillfully. I don't have to be identified with these thoughts and with these feelings. Another way to cultivate right livelihood is to be conscious of avoiding harm to oneself and others. Just considering the manner of our work. How do we represent ourselves in the workplace? How do we represent ourselves in the world? How do we address customers? How do we address coworkers? How do we treat ourselves? Notice the tendency to blame others or ourselves. Being blameless is, in the face of challenges, is very, very difficult. So I used to think that I needed to find the dream job. You know, I read Joseph Campbell, Follow Your Bliss. And for a while, I thought the dream job would be to be a Playboy photographer. Sounded pretty good at the time, but anyway, that never happened. And but I think, you know, the dream job is really based largely on our perspective and our attitude. And we can actually find joy in any job. I remember living in Rochester back in the 80s. You think this is cold? I mean, I laugh at people, you know, when it snows a little bit. I know, Giorgio, you're smirking now. Rightfully so, but we get like this much snow and everybody freaks out, right? I mean, I used to live where we got 150 inches of snow a year. And I had a job one time where I was working the night shift. It was in a factory. I actually worked in a foundry. And I would get in my car about 11 o'clock at night and I would drive in a blizzard to work. And one time I looked at my gas gauge and it was getting low. So I pulled into a gas station that was open at 11 o'clock at night in a blizzard. And this guy comes out, and this was back in the day where they pumped gas for you, right? Rolled down my window. I said, fill it up, please. This guy was the happiest guy I ever saw. He's got like a snowmobile suit on, you know, and he's smiling. Hi, sir, what would you like? And I thought, what's wrong with this guy? Doesn't he understand it's like 4 degrees outside, the chill factor's minus 30, it's a blizzard. Guy, your job sucks. Why? How could you be so happy? I never did find out a secret, but somehow he had found joy in his work. And you know the irony is? I was driving to work smoking a joint. Because I hated my job so much, the only way I could stand it was to go stoned. Seriously, true story. True story. Yeah. How I didn't kill myself in that foundry is a miracle. So, I had a coworker, and I will say where this was at Earth Fair, a guy named Eric. And one time, Eric and I were talking about the fact that management never listened to us. You know, didn't really listen to our opinions. And Eric looked at me and he said, you know, I finally understood that my experience, and this guy had a lot of experience, my experience and my opinion doesn't matter. I'm just here to be of service. And that was his attitude. When he clocked in, he said, I'm just here to serve. And I thought, what a great attitude. If everything I do, I just have the attitude, I'm just here to serve. And I can find gratitude and look for gratitude in just the fact that I have a job and I don't live in Aleppo. Can that really shift my perspective about my job and maybe help me find some joy and purpose in my work and not hang out for that Playboy photographer job? It's probably really not all it's cut out to be. Tell me it is. It isn't. Yeah. Anyway, so I'm very blessed now because the work that I do, some of you know I'm a substance abuse counselor and I'm a meditation teacher, and I teach meditation and do groups with people in recovery. And I feel really blessed because I'm a person in long-term recovery, and I've been through it all, you know, in my active addiction. But I'm able to take my experiences that I've had as a meditator, as a person in recovery, and go in and help people. And it's hard work sometimes. You know, sometimes they die. Sometimes I show up and they'll pull me aside and say, "Do you remember Jason? He overdosed. Do you remember Carl? He drowned in his own vomit this week." You know, this stuff happens. And yet I just feel so blessed. And this week, I should have brought it with me. I got a little handwritten sign at the school that I teach at, and one of the students handed me this little handwritten note thanking me on behalf of the body of students, the student body, for being an inspiration and a motivator in helping them. And I looked at him and I said, "You're going to make me cry right as I'm starting the group." I'm just so blessed that I have a sense of purpose and joy in my work, and I know that I'm making a difference in what I do. And I hope that's true for all of you as well.